Okay, so today is February 18th, thank you, 2015. This is the first interview with Dr. Thomas J. Archdeacon. I am here, my name is Troy Reeves, and we are here at the Mossy Humanities Building in Tom's office, or at least for now, Tom's office. Tom, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
It's Thomas Archdeacon, and it's A-R-C-H-D-E-A-C-O-N.
That's great. I'm just going to slide this a little closer to you. You can talk at that level you just spoke at. I may just have to speak up a little bit to get our questions on. So, Tom, as I said before I turned on the recorder, I gave you a list of topics in advance, so we're just going to start from the top. And the first question is, where or from whom did you develop an interest in history?
That may have been the hardest question you asked. I wouldn't say from any person in particular. I think it was a product of several forces. For some reason, I always was interested in it. There's a point where I can't think of a time when I wasn't. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, I think that sports had something to do with it. When I was a little kid, I still am a baseball fan, but it started, I think that was the first sport in which I was interested, and it started fairly early when I was 6 or 7. And I just sort of, I read about it, and I became interested in the history of teams and the like, mm-hmm. and that was it. I think part of it, I remember having one picture book in particular about World War II, the Navy in World War II, that I remember reading repeatedly as a child, going through it and trying to figure out. It was very sparse. It was primarily pictures with just a caption under them, not much context, and sort of being curious about that. I think part of it had to do with the fact that my parents were immigrants and I was trying to understand my situation. I wouldn't have put it in such a profound way back then, but I do think that there were probably maybe cues that children who were longer rooted in the society automatically had fed to them that I didn't automatically have fed to me, and I had to do a certain amount of construction on them. Those, I think, would probably be the main reasons why.
I'm going to assume you are or were a Yankees fan growing up?
Yes, I was, and I continue to be.
What were your Yankees teams? What era did you start?
Oh, I had the really good era. I think the first time I listened to baseball was probably around 1948, which was not a Yankee year. But then 49 through 53 were World Series victories, won right after the other. So that was a thing. I mean, growing up in New York, you were either naturally a Yankees fan, a Giants fan, or a Brooklyn Dodger fan, unless you broke the mold in some way. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised that if it were that the Yankees, being on a winning streak at that time, were more in the news and they were successful and I was a bandwagon jumper, mm-hmm. or something. You know, kids 6, 7 years of age, that you don't consider yourself venal in that way. Mm-hmm. But then I, really got into the team and I admire their success and sort of the quality of the product that they put out and the tradition. And I really got, didn't become a fanatic, but I was a very serious baseball fan and just sort of stayed with it over time. Then, of course, when the Giants and the Dodgers left, that was it. But I was fairly indiscriminate. I mean, I liked the Yankees. If three baseball games are on, the Yankees were it, I would watch the Yankee game or listen to it. Okay. If they weren't on, I'd listen to a Giants game or a Dodgers game. I didn't. If the Yankees played the Dodgers in the World Series, I rooted for the Yankees, but I didn't have particularly malicious feelings to the other New York teams or anything.
Right, that the baseball documentary that Ken Burns did called the 50s was, I think he called it the era of New York or something.
Yeah, it was. I mean, one team or the other, or two teams in a given year, were in the World Series almost through the entire time. In fact, I can't think right offhand now of a year. Well, 1959 would have been the first year that of the 50s in which at least one New York team wasn't playing, and even in that year, it was the Los Angeles Dodgers were playing. And then in 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, those were still all years in which the Yankees were in. So basically, there was about a 15 or 16 year period in which a New York team, with that one exception of 59, if you want to get technical about it, because the Dodgers had moved, that there was a New York team or a team with New York roots in the World Series.
And you said your parents were immigrants. Do you think you're interested in, I mean, you said that that's part of your interest in history, but specifically your interest in immigration, do you think came from?
Probably, but not directly. That was a much more sinister development. When I went to graduate school, at that point, there was relatively little interest in immigration history. I mean, there were a few classic books about which people knew, and but in general, the students who were doing immigrant history, as I looked around in graduate school, were not a particularly impressive group. They were kind of very ethnic in a sense. They were sort of quite parochial in their vision. And I was very eager not to be that. I wasn't, you know, that I wanted to forget my roots or anything like that. But I didn't want to bury myself in them. But then I did my dissertation, which was on colonial New York, and one of the themes in that dissertation was what I considered to be an underlying political tension between the English and the Dutch long after, 30, 40 years after the English had taken power, that I still thought there were undercurrents. Not everybody agrees with me on that. But I thought I saw it there. So my dissertation ended up having a kind of ethnic twist to it, unintentionally. This was not what I was looking for when I went into the writing of the project. And then when I got here, I came as a colonial historian, and within a year or two after I got here, the history had an enrollment crisis in a way. And the men who were working in colonial history were far senior to me and better established. And I put my finger up to the wind and started figuring out, how am I going to survive here? And I didn't abandon colonial history, but I figured I ought to have another arrow in my quiver. And at that point, people were beginning to get interested in ethnic group relations and immigration and and the like, and I did go into that field. Now, that became a little bit more complicated because I don't think I was a typical historian of immigration. In many cases, you find people who have a specialty in a particular ethnic group and that. I became much more interested in it as a process, whether it was immigration or ethnic group relations, as a process or a question of structures that fostered or failed to foster integration, rather than interested in a particular ethnic group. And I have always tended to approach it that way. Now, part of it, I think, was maybe the lingering effect of not wanting to be considered, you know, just a person who knows about this group in history. That may have been part of it. I don't know. It wasn't on a highly conscious level, but it may have been on a less conscious level. I think more important was even from the time of my dissertation, I had been interested in the use of quantitative evidence in history, and the kind of sources that were attracting me tended to be more general sources, statistical sources, less the people's remembrances than it was sort of factual data that I could find, or at least factual in the sense that they could be backed up with numerical argumentation. Obviously, there are other ways of backing up facts as well, but that was attracting me, and I think that took me along in a particular direction, because one thing I found as I studied immigration and ethnicity, at a certain level, I wouldn't say weakened my ties to the department. I remained fully involved in the department in my teaching and committee work and everything like that, but it did sort of reorient me toward more interaction with people in other fields rather than with historians per se. And so I found myself reading in sociology and economics, for example, to a fairly substantial extent, because they were dealing with immigration. Another thing I liked about immigration, in a way, is, and ethnic group relations, I really look at both parts. I don't really separate them. They're more like different stages in the study of the same process. Another thing that I liked about them was that I find that historians have a tendency, and students of history have a tendency, to be fairly judgmental. You know, we look back 50 years or 75 years ago, and I find this is actually true of a lot of historians of immigration, and they go, you know, these people were so dumb to look at it this way, and implicitly, we would never make the same mistake. And yet, especially as immigration and ethnic group relations got to be a hotter and hotter subject in contemporary political debate and to be very divisive in many respects, I found that useful in dealing with students when you'd say, well, you know, what's your attitude on this? You know, you see we're divided. We don't quite know what to do. Maybe we should have a little bit of sympathy for people back then, because 50 years from now, somebody's going to say to us that, or is going to be saying, see how stupid they were back then. The obvious solution was, or we all got through it, or whatever. So there were various things, not all coming from the same source, but various feeds, each one tending in some way to reinforce the other or to supplement the other, that sort of pulled me in this direction. And gradually then over time, I just became less interested, not less interested in the colonial period, but there, other people were hired. There was less of a role for me to play there. Frankly, I wasn't as up to date on the literature in that area anymore as I was in my own areas of specialty, and so I kind of drifted away. I mean, occasionally when they needed another reader for a dissertation in early American history, I still was competent enough that you could pull me in and I could say something reasonably perceptive about some general aspect of the student's work. So I remained useful in that way, but people then accepted me as a person who does this kind of history rather than the rather than primarily what I was hired to do. I think I'd also like to add something about, in terms of why I got into history. In a naive way, I think I was interested in the truth, in the assumption that, there are these controversies and these disagreements, and we looked at them, if we look at them carefully enough and, I'll use the word objectively enough, that you can come to a resolution. And then I became, as I matured, I started recognizing how simplistic that view was in a way. And at the same time, while recognizing how simplistic it was in a way, I also recognized a kind of Pontius Pilate quality to a lot of historical work, in the sense that what is truth? And I think in the sort of central period of my career, a lot of assumptions about the unity, or if not unity, at least the idea that there was a canon of historical knowledge, the idea of what is appropriate argumentation, what is proof, in some way, some of those standards I believe broke down in a way that I don't think was completely constructive. Now, I don't want to sound like an old man, bitter or something like that. I don't feel that way, but I think that for at least a portion in the central and later part of my career, history became much more involved with the presentation of plausible arguments and a balancing of worldviews rather than in a question of, if you wanted to say a more scientific kind of expectation of being able to disprove some points of view. And then I think that also had an impact to my career in a way was, I wouldn't say badly timed, but there's a certain amount of ill-fitting in a way. When I started my career, history was moving very much in the direction of social sciences, and I was taken with that. And part of this interest in quantification was based, and not that quantification is the answer to anything, to everything, by any stretch of the imagination, but it seemed to me another tool by which you could eliminate the viability of certain hypotheses about how things worked. It seemed to offer a more systematic approach there than a selective presentation of anecdotes or the picking out of here and there of quotes that supported a particular point of view. But the profession really moved away from that, certainly in the central part of my career. And I didn't change with it very much. I think part of that may have affected why I continue to work more with immigration and ethnic group relations, because in the other fields that were handling it, those kinds of quantitatively based arguments and hypotheses testing and the like still remained a standard part of the set of tools that people use to approach that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that, you know, insofar I didn't, as I said, I didn't get alienated at all from the history department. I like the history department in general. I like, well, you know, there's some people I'm closer to than to other people. Sometimes it's just a matter of you're 20 or 30 years older than somebody and you don't have many natural occasions to interact with them. Your kids had played soccer 15 years ahead and they're now seeing each other at soccer games. You know, natural kind of things. It's not any form of dislike or whatever. It's just stages of life. But I mean, so I like people, like the history department. I like the people in the history department. But in terms of where I saw myself fitting intellectually, I sort of increasingly felt that I'm not using the kinds of approaches that are much more, that are most attractive now. I think one way I could express that would be when you come to Wisconsin as a when you come to Wisconsin as a faculty member, you are asked, or depending on your department, it might be assumed that you are going to be a member of a particular division of the university, whether it's humanities or natural sciences or social, well, it depends on the committee, whether they call it social sciences or social studies. When I came in, I chose to be part of the social studies divisional committee. And I think at the time I was coming in, probably as many new hires were choosing that or as were choosing humanities. It might not have been evenly divided, but it wasn't an odd choice. Now I think that almost inevitably anyone who gets hired comes in as a humanist. And that has to do, I think, with several things. Some of it has to do with the oddities of the way that the university is, or not oddities, but just the mechanisms by which the university is governed. When I was new, the history department, I think in terms of, the history department reported to the Associate Dean for Social Sciences, even though you could be a humanities person or a socialist thing, the department as a whole reported to the social sciences. But in the 80s sometime, it was decided that it should go over to the humanities chair, and obviously most of the department agreed with him at that point that it should go over to the humanities. Now, at the time, I think it was a combination of two factors. There was one, that's a little bit of the way that the drift was going. People were coming in with that orientation. And two, another important driving force was the search for graduate support. And the feeling was that our graduate students would compete better against the humanities departments, in part because the humanities departments were seen as weaker than the social studies departments, particularly in areas when they took into consideration things like math scores. How did you do on your GREs? How did you do on your GRE mathematics? Well, usually the historians would come in and they'd have great verbal scores and they'd have so-so, if that, mathematics scores. Whereas the people where quantitative analysis and the like was really central to what they did, economists, for example, or this sociologist, maybe less clear in the case of the sociologist, but certainly a subset of them did, psychologists, these folks would probably have had much more exposure to statistics and things of that nature as undergraduates than our people would have, and they were considered then, well, they're being measured against this set of students, and it's really not akin to what most of them will be doing when they're here. Mm-hmm. And that if you take a look at, we can sort of stand toe-to-toe with the humanities departments in this, and indeed we think we're better than the other humanities departments. Now, there's a great deal of chauvinism in that, and I'm not saying that the other departments really were weaker, although I think we believed that they were. They probably believed the reverse.
A couple of things based on what you've said here. I want to go back to baseball.
Sure.
Because I grew up a baseball fan, and baseball to me was, you know, seeing watching the game, yeah, and also the statistics.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, football to a lesser extent is statistic driven, and basketball even sort of less, I think. Yeah. Although, again, you could argue.
Yeah, I mean, now what they're doing is all of these sports are history. Baseball had a history of always using statistics. What we see now with some of these other sports is that they are developing their own history statistics, and in terms of like the professional leagues, basketball has a rather short history of being, the NBA basically dates from the 1950s, the National Football League goes back a little bit farther, but when you're dealing with baseball, you can go back to the 1880s, and there might be questions about dead ball era versus live ball era and the like, but you can. And some people would say it's not a very accurate story, but you can play with the numbers in all kinds of way over an enormous stretch of time.
And so
it might be that the slower pace of the game, too, in the sense of, it seems to be baseball's. The pitcher throws the ball, the batter swings at it and perhaps hits it, and a real baseball fan knows that at that point everybody has some kind of responsibility for responding, even if it's not the person to whom the ball is hit. There's anticipation of scenarios that can be developing, and you're supposed to position yourself here or be ready to do that and the like. But I think for the immediate viewer, you're focusing usually on one, two, or three people. And with football, even though we probably focus on the quarterback, or in basketball, the person who has the ball in his or her hands at a given moment, those are games really that are in which the flow of action is much more constant, I think, in a way, and probably doesn't allow one to think as systematically about each instance that it occurs. I mean, every time you snap the ball in football, there is a play. Every time somebody grabs a rebound, there is some kind of play. Before a ball is hit or caught or anything like that, a ball might be thrown between the pitcher and catcher 7-8 times or whatever.
So I have a sort of a simplistic idea here, is that what do you suppose your interest in baseball and perhaps the statistical part of baseball made you gravitate towards more quantitative analysis or more social science than that?
It could very well be. I remember being in grammar school one day, and the teacher was trying to teach us about averages, and I remember that she miscomputed how you would do a baseball hitting average. It was probably a nice effort on her part to make it relevant to, you know, a class of, well, boys and girls, but let's say 10-year-old those 10-year-old boys who weren't paying attention. But instead of, I can't remember what it was, let's say she would be defining a 300 hitter as a 700 hitter or something. I mean, she had it backwards. Mm-hmm. And I think probably didn't know the sport very well and thought, well, you know, the fact that a really good person only gets it right 3 out of 10 times doesn't seem to make sense. Maybe she thought it made more sense. And I remember correcting her about that, which was probably something I didn't do very often, given that I remember it. But you know, I was always kind of into that, getting it right and the like. It might very well have had something to do with that.
And then you mentioned that as you went along and became more of a immigration historian or a professor of immigration mm-hmm. history, you gravitated more towards other social science. Departments or degrees.
That's right. I would say that when I present my class, in fact, I had usually a quasi warning in my syllabus that if you know you expect this to be stories about grandma and a lot of literature and the like, this is not my approach. Mm-hmm. You know, expect to see graphs, expect to hear number arguments with numbers in it, expect to hear discussions of group behavior, you know, things of that nature. And I would say probably, I haven't done a study of this systematically at all, but if you were to take any given lecture of mine, well, it would depend on the particular day, I'm sure, but let's say overall, if you were to take any given lecture of mine and trace the sources on which I was basing that lecture, I imagine that a goodly number and maybe a majority of them would not fit in history narrowly defined. History is produced by a historian there. I mean, obviously it could have been produced by a sociologist who had historical interest or an economist who had historical interest, but the journal out of which I got it or the book out of which I got it, depending on when you're dealing with the social sciences, you're usually getting more out of journals than out of books, but from which I got it would have been in those fields. As likely as in history. And I felt really no guilt about it because I was looking at this as a historian. I remain conventionally a historian in the sense that I approached it linearly. I started at the beginning and moved forward. The narrative, a story of how we got from one date to another, I tried to create that. So I would say it was being used, these sources were being used in a basic historical manner, the way I was using them, the way that a historian, to construct what a historian would consider a piece of history. But I wasn't just drawing from the kind of narrative tradition that was common in most historians' works on these subjects.
So as you move from a colonial historian to an immigration historian, what classes were you teaching here?
I taught, let's see, the classes that I've taught here, when I first came, I was teaching colonial history. When I first got here, I replaced a man named Stan Katz, a very fine colonial historian who I think went down to the University of Chicago at that point. Eventually he became the head of the American Council of Learned Societies. But Katz was a man who had training in law. I don't think he actually had a law degree, but he was very interested. He might have, but I'm not positive about that. He was very interested in legal history. And I believe that when he went down to Chicago, he was working both legal, to a certain extent, with the law school and with the college. He had primarily done 18th century history, 1700s. There was another man here, the man who, in effect, became my mentor here, and of whom I was very fond and who was very supportive of me, named David Lovejoy, who did primarily 17th century history. His real area of expertise was the Glorious Revolution. And oddly enough, my own first book was tangentially about the Glorious Revolution, a period 10 or 15 years after it, but certainly there. And Lovejoy and I did not really disagree on the Glorious Revolution, but he nevertheless was in favor of hiring me, and he was very supportive of me, and which was interesting and I think quite characteristic of the department in those days. And then the third person was Merrill Jensen, who was kind of a giant and who was doing revolutionary history. That's where his real fame was as a historian of the Revolution and Constitution. But Merrill at that point was primarily dealing with graduate students and editing papers related to the Constitutional Convention and the first federal elections and the like. And so when I first got here, I taught some colonial history. I might teach like a graduate seminar or something, but I didn't teach the basic colonial lecture course. Lovejoy taught that. And instead, I taught the Revolution course. And that made me a bit nervous as an assistant professor, because I figured that when Jensen retired, they would want to, one, I wasn't a historian of the Revolution, I was a historian of the colonial period. They might very well want somebody who was more thoroughly in the Revolution. And Jensen was such a major figure in the history of the Revolution. I mean, there were a handful of people in his generation who were just dominant figures in it, like Richard Morris, who was my mentor, and Bernard Bailyn and Jensen. They didn't agree with each other on lots of stuff, but everybody agreed that Edmund Morgan, that these were all, you know, the folks that you watch, that in terms of maintaining its prestige and the like, Wisconsin might very well not want to put this in the control of an assistant professor and might want to bring in somebody who was an established heavy hitter at that time. To a certain extent, they did that in that they brought in Pauline Mayer, who stayed very briefly. I mean, but they did. But meanwhile, these were the calculations that I was doing that partly affected my move over toward immigration history was, Dave Lovejoy, I had no desire in any way to push him aside. Dave Lovejoy is a colonial history and he has been doing this for 20 or 30 years or whatever. He's not going to move to do something else. They have me teaching Jensen's course. But they didn't really hire me to teach Jensen's course. What they hired me to do was 18th century, and in effect, the market for colonial historians and history enrollments in general is such that you don't really need more than one colonialist at this point. So I better find ways to make myself useful. So that was the kind of more devious origins of what I did. And it's fairly easy because, I mean, what was I? I was a person who had done a dissertation on colonial history. It was a few years out of graduate school. At that time, I think people, I was 30 when I got the job. I had taught for 3 years before, but I was 30 when I arrived here. And basically, I guess I was probably 71. I would have been 28 when I finished my dissertation. Nowadays, my God, we get people here, they're in their mid-30s or 40s by the time they're getting here. And so they've invested years and years and years in a field. For me, it was a couple of years in graduate school and doing a project that I found interesting. And it did deal with ethnic groups and the like, and it did have some quantification in it, and seeing what I could do with this immigration thing didn't seem like a bad idea. It'd be useful, and I was kind of interested in it, and you know, so it wasn't quite Machiavellian in what I did. It was a natural enough move, but there was a question of, well, you want to survive and you want to be useful, you know. Combines.
So then, did you move into courses that were already...
No, I created. Okay. There was nobody doing it. Okay.
So what type of courses did you create and then teach?
I'd say my kind of go-to course was a general survey of immigration and ethnicity. And then I sometimes taught a course on the same subject but focused on the 20th century. And then I did graduate courses in it. Sometimes I did undergraduate seminars on some aspect of immigration or immigration policy. So I did that. I taught quantitative history, quantitative methods was a course I developed because there were a handful of us who could have done it, but I was the one. John Sharpless did it a little bit, and I did it a little bit. Eventually, the shift became was that there wasn't enough demand among enough students, so I would continue to, as John would as well, to advise individual students on quantitative methods and the like, but that was just like several years in the 80s, I'd say, that I gave the quantitative history course. That had been on the book because there had been a tradition at Wisconsin. Tradition might be too strong. The interest in quantification here in Wisconsin developed a number of years before I arrived. It would have been in the person of Al Bogue, for example, in American history, and Peter Smith in Latin American history, who would have been very big in it. There had been a very strong connection with the economics department too, and although actually probably the best people in it were in the economics department, Jeff Williamson and Claudia Golden, both of whom later moved to Harvard, but there was a seminar that was between history and economics where you had people doing this. So there was a great deal of interest in quantification here when I arrived, and there was a course in it, but Bogue, I don't know whether he ever taught it or not, he was certainly less interested in teaching by that point. Peter Smith, who I think did most of the teaching of that course, left. He went initially to MIT, and so that course then wasn't being done, and I was getting more systematically interested in quantification. And so then Sharpless and I each did it from time to time.
Mm-hmm. You've offered a few names here. I want to back up
Sure.
And asked specifically. So you mentioned David Lovejoy as a fellow colonialist, but also someone who ended up being your mentor.
Yeah.
So I wonder, besides him, or if you want to elaborate on that, who were some of the other folks when you first got here that either you sought out to befriend or came and befriended you?
Oh, it was really a nice group when I got here. I mean, I would say that people with whom I became, well, let's say people to whom I looked up and who were nice to me in return. I mean, I don't, maybe that's not the best way to think. They certainly were supportive of me, right? Would have been Alan Bogue, right? He certainly influenced me. David Lovejoy was, although our approaches were, you know, David was pure humanist and stuff like that. He was kind of he was a protective presence. Not that he went out and, you know, I can't say, well, I got myself in this scrape or something and David knew how to get me out. That wasn't the kind of thing. But it was a question that he sort of kept me grounded and, you know, talked to me about history and was, you know, he didn't check up on me so much that I was doing this or that, but he sort of just was generally encouraging. And then there were a number of other people who were just people that I found nice and interested, and there are people like Bob Burkhofer who left. He left after I was here just a year or two, but the year, first year or two when I was here, Bob Burkhofer, who was very interested in sort of behavioral sciences and history, he was a person. Paul Konkin, who was really a very different kind of guy, he was a I would describe Konkin as a logician. He was very much in the humanist tradition and at all, but he was an intellectual historian, but at that high end of intellectual history, rather than popular culture, he was really interested in the working of ideas and tearing them apart and the like. And he was a person who, if he read something, he could make you quake in your boots, because he just would recognize any shortcoming in the argument. He would be much better to be his colleague than his student, I would say. Norm Ristjord was still around. I mean, he's not teaching, he's long retired, but he was a good man. Paul Glad, who left for the University of Oklahoma after a few years, he was good. John Cooper became my very good friend. He was two or three years older than me, but he was, he basically was tenured when I got here. But he became a person I admired and kind of, I wouldn't say as a model or something like that, but he seemed to know what he was doing, and I'd listen to what ever Cooper had to say about something, and usually found something worthwhile. And then there were other, you know, there were other folks who were sort of just closer to my age, and they certainly didn't have any power over me because they weren't tenured or anything like that. I didn't have to be seeking to impress them or anything, outside of the fact that you just want people to respect you. You don't want to be a dummy. But, I mean, people like John Sharpless and Maris Vinovskis, who also left, V-I-N-O-V-S-K-I-S, Diane Lindstrom, roughly my age, Jim Donnelly, who's a very close personal, you know, remains a very close personal friend. So, but they were essentially in the same, boat is, as I was. They were just finding their way around, and we were essentially the same age, and they had kids and the like, all those kinds of cohort things. But I mean, the people that I first mentioned there, like Bogue, Jensen was very supportive, although less directly involved in the day-to-day workings of the department. So Bogue, Lovejoy, Konkin, Glad, these were people that I admired and watched what they did and how they were behaving.
Maybe one more thing for today, and we'll see where this goes. So you mentioned folks in the history department, but you also said that as you became an immigration historian, and also sticking with sort of your quantitative, were there other folks on campus and other departments that probably primarily because of your work and perhaps theirs?
Yeah, David Ward over in geography, Marty Cadwallader over in geography. Marty's more my age. I sort of was more established when I got to know him. We were probably both at the associate professor level when we got to know each other. But I always admire Marty Cadwallader. Bob Ostergren over in geography. Chuck Hallaby up in sociology. Bob Hauser up in sociology. Some other folks as Hester, blanking on his first name right now, it's H-E-S-T-E-R, Hester up in economics.
And how would you get to know these folks because you got to know their work, or just because you happen to be on the same campus and would end up sort of rubbing shoulders at the same type of events?
Both.
Okay.
Both. I mean, Ward, I think, had a membership in the history department, at least an honorary one, because he had done very historical geographic work. So Cities and Immigrants was one of his books, and that quite influenced me. Bob Hauser, when I would be trying to learn about computers quantification. I mean, he was just terrific at that stuff. Hal Winsborough up in sociology, too, was a really supportive guy. Marwell, blanking in Marwell's first name now, too. Gosh, it's been a while since I've been. But they were, I would go to them with questions and
the like. Tom, understanding fully that we're going to meet at least next week and probably meet at least one or two more times, is there anything on your mind about what we've been talking about today, which kind of seems sort of like an overview of your time here, that you'd like to get on the recording before we wrap it up for the day?
Well, I think it's been an interesting evolution. One thing I liked about the department was that it gave me the freedom to have that evolution. I mean, I never abandoned the department in any sense. I always try to pull my weight. But I could have seen if people had said to me, well, no, we hired you to be a colonial historian, and we want you doing this. If you want to do this stuff in your spare time, fine. Or they could have discouraged me or anything like that. But they didn't. They were supportive, so that I didn't, as I made these changes and adjustments, I never felt that there was anyone looking over my shoulder saying, no, you shouldn't. Okay. I could also mention another person among people who had an effect on me was Rogers Hollingsworth. More in the sense that he was a man who did similar work in that it bridged departments. Now, he eventually became officially a member of the sociology department as well as history. And I was much more on a, you know, a kind of pull from this one what you can use and pull from that one what you can use, rather than wholly giving myself over to an additional discipline. But he was a person who worked in this interdisciplinary fashion. And I think a number of people, maybe not in the same way that I did, also had connections in other departments and the like. And, but I would say, especially for that sort of movement from the colonial period into an entirely different area, I didn't get any flack for that. The other thing that I might qualify that comment a little bit, in the sense that I think I was also a pretty good department citizen, in that I was one of those people who, if you needed something done, I would do it. You know, I always had good enrollments. If you needed somebody on a committee, I would do it. I don't think I ever was had much of the prima donna about me in terms of, well, it has to be my way or it hasn't, or if you ask me to do this, it's going to interfere too much with some project I have. So I think I took what I also gave. Mm-hmm. And so it was a good cooperative environment, and in that sense, I had goodwill and people had goodwill in return.
Great. Well, we're going to meet again next week, so this concludes the first interview with Dr. Thomas Archdeacon. Thank you, sir.
Okay.